Can the grandfather of Canada's current foreign affairs minister be excused for his involvement editing and publishing a Nazi newspaper during the war? Are the wartime activities of Michael Chomiak relevant to the political activities of his granddaughter, Chrystia Freeland, 7 decades later? Why would Ukrainian nationalists linked to Nazi aggression in Eastern Europe be welcomed to Canada? What parallels are there between wartime revisionism around the role of Ukrainian nationalists during World War II and Canadian politicians like Lynn Bayek, who attempt to whitewash Indian residential schools? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we explore the troubling news coming out of Ottawa that the maternal grandfather of Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was a Nazi collaborator, and about the disturbing history of the Canadian government's embrace of fellow Ukrainian nationalists with Russophobic views and allegiances with the Nazis of that wartime era. We'll hear perspectives from Moscow-based correspondent John Helmer and from Ottawa-based researcher and writer Richard Sanders. On this week's Global Research News Hour, Defending the Indefensible, Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister revises family history of Nazi collaboration. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 31st, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory of the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Freedom of speech in the U.S. cannot be openly stopped without fatal loss of legitimacy of rule. So the rest follows. All the non-corporate and non-profit messages from the critical sites on the Internet Commons, which are speaking against the U.S. war state, inside, are now vilified as quote-unquote fake news. A third unofficial protagonist has entered the battle with no private profit or career motive or corporate boss to serve and a wealth of proven professional knowledge and talent at work. It has to be denounced to sustain the big lies of the ruling money war game, which is in deepening crises and conflicts all the way to the unprecedented U.S. President Press Civil War. That comes from the article, Fake News, The Unraveling of U.S. Empire from Within, by Professor John McMurtry, posted March 27th. Universities are thought to be the last bastion of independent thought, where ideas and topics are tested and discussed by experts in research and critical thinking. But now, universities are being hobbled by dark state agencies that require a deluded public to advance their criminal projects. Dark state agencies advance narrow transnational corporate interests, not national interests, beneath the lies, the public relations courtesans, the CIA fabrications, and Pentagon overlords. The propaganda budget for the Pentagon alone is reported to be more than $500 million annually. Those who seek peace, truth, the rule of international law, as well as democratic, political, and economic systems, are the unstated enemies of our largely covert governing polities. That comes from the article, Shooting the Messenger, The Last Bastions of Independent Thought, by Mark Taliano, posted March 26th. As the world turns its anger and hatred towards the Saudis, with help from Western media, which points their fingers at the Saudis for their actions in Yemen, UAE is kept above the fray. Whereas, in fact, the UAE is home to Eric Prince, the founder of notorious Blackwater, it is training a UAE-led militia force and UAE's complicity in the crimes deserve to be discussed separately. Suffice it to say that as the Saudis fall from grace, the UAE continues to climb in America's plots and those of her allies. The Saudis, on the other hand, are being used by the West and sadly for them and their victims, they continued to play the role of gladiators. That was an excerpt from an interview with Soraya Sepapur Ulrich for Tasnim News Agency under the headline, U.S. NATO is using Saudi Arabia. The West is the true perpetrator of genocide in Yemen genocide, posted March 26. Saudi Arabia is the hotbed of the most radical Muslim terrorists in the world, the Salafis. Both ISIS and Al-Qaeda are Salafis. And the Saudis, with U.S. support, back the radical madrasas in which Islamic radicalism was spread. And yet the U.S. has been supporting the Saudis militarily, with NSA intelligence and in every other way possible through the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. Trump? He's selling them massive amounts of arms, keeping them off of the list of restricted countries for immigration, and supporting Saudi war crimes in Yemen. That comes from the article, Trump equals Obama equals Bush equals Clinton on four core issues, by Washington's blog, posted March 27th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Records opened by the Polish government in Warsaw reveal that Michael Chomiak, grandfather of the current Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, was the chief editor and publisher of a newspaper which disseminated Nazi propaganda out of Krakow in German-occupied Poland during World War II. Should the sins of the grandfather be visited upon the granddaughter? Are there other or related reasons why Canadians should be concerned about Minister Freeland in her current role in the Trudeau cabinet? Joining us to discuss these issues is John Helmer. John Helmer is the longest continuously serving foreign correspondent in Russia and the only Western journalist to direct his own bureau independent of single national or commercial ties. John Helmer, thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You were familiar with Chrystia Freeland. I know you had some interactions back in the day when she was a Moscow correspondent for the Financial Post, Financial Times.
Times.
Yes. Can you share any conversations with or observances of Freeland from that era that might help us maybe better understand her politics and her approach to journalism?
Our interactions, Ms. Freeland's and mine, were not when she was with the FT. She started as a minor stringer in the Ukraine, as a sort of post-grad university student, and my relationship with the Moscow Bureau of the Financial Times has always been a bit strained, and it wasn't any better with her than with her predecessors or her successors, and that's because the FT promotes the making of money at any political cost. And during those years, the FT's Moscow Bureau promoted every vice, perversion, and political destructiveness that was associated with Boris Yeltsin's administration. Ms. Freeland moved out of Moscow, if I recall the sequence correctly, to Toronto, where she became an editor at the Globe and Mail. And our interactions had to do with the fact that I was the responsible for a while in covering Canadian business in Russia. There was a correspondent of the Globe and Mail who covered all the rest, the politics and so forth, and the hot news stories. But I focused on analyzing, reporting in some greater detail than is customary these days, on Canadian mining companies and other Canadian business interests and business stories in Russia. And there were a lot of those at the time. And basically, Ms. Freeland considered herself an expert, and to a degree she was. And she would have very strong opinions about how stories should be reported, what the facts were. She had very little respect for the reporter on the ground. In that case, it happened to be me. And on the other end, if I were contacted from Toronto on a story I'd filed, she would express a disagreement with a high-pitched scream. And as I understand it, in those days, there were many recipients of Ms. Freeland's expression of opinion at a high-pitched scream, which led to a certain amount of nicknaming of her, not Christia Freeland, but Hysteria Freeland. But that's a long time ago, and maybe she's controlled the decibel levels of her voice, but not her opinions and not her degree of opinionation.
The story that you know, that's been circulating throughout the press has been about her grandfather's Nazi collaborationist past. It seems like there have been some interesting reactions, and in fact, there's even been some defense of Minister Freeland. I'm just going to read you a quote from an article by one Paul Wells for the Toronto Star that appeared in early March, and I think is somewhat emblematic of her defenders. He says, and I quote, "What we know is that if Chomiak was still alive at the end of the war, it's because he took pains to stay on the right side of the murderers who had occupied Ukraine and Poland for the war's duration. Everyone did. Everyone had to. You might be a resistor for 3 hours a day after collaborating the other 21. Those who didn't manage to escape to the West, as Chomiak and his family did, stayed behind and spent generations staying on the right side of the new occupiers, the Stalinist murderers who took over from the Nazis." So basically, he's making some, you know, concessions for him, being saying that, you know, he had to do what he had to do in order to survive. Do you buy that at all?
No, I don't. Mr. Wells is a fool, and he demonstrates that he can't understand he can understand neither the history of the time nor the issues at the present. Let me speak a little longer than the usual soundbite on this point. The story about Miss Freeland, the reason she has to be accountable to Canadian public opinion, common sense, and political morality these days, is has two elements. She lies about the past, and she's lying about the present. The thing that Canadian listeners need to focus on is whether they want to fund as taxpayers the kind of lying about the Ukraine which Ms. Freeland represents. But let's go back to the history a minute and Mr. Wells's stupidities. First of all, Chomiak family were more than Nazi collaborators. They were what you could call profiteers from the misery and murder of those days. Chomiak was a well-educated graduate in journalism and law from Lvov. He made a journalism career of some insignificance until the German army invaded first Poland and then the Ukraine. From that point on, he became an active proponent of the what used to be called before World War I, for very briefly, the Kingdom of Galicia. That's Western Ukraine, extending its territory northward into Poland and eastward towards Kiev and southwards as well. What Chomiak did was profit significantly from the liquidation of both Jews and Poles in the area of the region of Galicia, and he was promoted by the German administration based in Krakow to run two newspapers, one in Krakow, Krakivtsi Visti, and the second newspaper in a smaller town, a weekly publication in Chelm. He made a career not only printing what he thought as well as what the German news was. He celebrated American troop casualties after German submarines sank troop ships in the Atlantic. He also received an apartment taken from Jews who were shipped off to a concentration camp and murdered. He made his career in a newspaper that was stolen from a Jewish media proprietor. Even the furniture in his apartment was stolen from Jews who were murdered. This is not a man whom you could characterize as a collaborationist for 3 hours a day while he resisted and acted morally for 21. Mr. Wells is a fool for not knowing the history. It's easy to know the history. Many Canadians have gone to Chomiak's papers in which they discovered who owned the furniture he sat on when he had dinner during the war years in Krakow. Now, the issue is, first of all, Wells doesn't know his history, but has been prevailed on to defend Chrystia Freeland as if all this issue is about the history. The issue isn't about the history of the grandfather's sins. There were lots of them. They're unforgivable. But there's more at stake for Ms. Freeland right now. And that's because she commits the same type of geopolitical sin her grandfather stood for. And that's the expansion of a particular ethnic region of the Western Ukraine into the entire Ukraine, accompanied by warfare and the cleansing of the region or of the country they called the Ukraine, which isn't. The cleansing of the country, now then of Jews and Poles, now of Russian speakers. So what is at stake and what isn't being debated in this in the Canadian mainstream media and can't be debated by fools like Wells is what does Freeland stand for using Canadian resources for the expansion of the Ukraine eastward against Russian speakers and northwards against the Poles. She's doing what, not what the Nazis did. She's doing what Western Ukrainians, Galicians, did at in Chomiak's time. The sin, geopolitically, is exactly the same. She's guilty of it, not simply for lying about the past, but for continuing it in the present.
I wanted to bring up the fact that Chrystia Freeland was brought into the Liberal fold as a star candidate in Toronto riding. And at the time, they were highlighting her journalism, especially her book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, you know, because Trudeau was wanting to focus on restoring prosperity for the middle class. And it seemed And Chrystia Freeland also was one of the handpicked people to work on the economic in their little internal economic think tank. I'm wondering what Miss Freeland's role or a little bit about your insights into some of the internal dynamics and what you've heard from your sources in Ottawa about where the appeal of Miss Freeland and some of the chaos that seems to be erupting with her appointment first as trade minister and now just recently as foreign affairs minister.
That's a bit tricky for me. As you understand, as listeners will understand, I'm not Canadian. I know Montreal better than Toronto. It's been a while since I've been in Canada, and I can't profess to speak with inside knowledge of Ottawa politics, let alone Liberal Party politics. What I understand, the rise of Miss Freeland is driven by lots of factors, one of which is her own personal ambition to be prime minister. How many bodies lie in the way of realizing that ambition, I don't know. If you're running for prime minister, not simply in Canada, but in, let's call it the British-type parliamentary democracies, one of the things you often shouldn't be doing is be foreign minister. That's because foreign ministers usually spend their time flying around the rest of the world and not at home taking care of the concerns, the domestic concerns. There are obvious priorities for voters at home. So usually in the old days, you would not get to be prime minister if you spent your time abroad. You ought to be a member of parliament focusing on domestic issues. You could be the minister of finance. You could be responsible for the budget. You could be responsible for a great many domestic issues, and you make sure you tour around the country and be visible, promoting yourself as a national candidate for national domestic issues. These days, however, you can somersault into the prime ministry if you develop a foreign policy image at home that looks all the things that a domestic prime minister can't be: tough, noisy, articulate, and all of the things that foreign ministers can be if they make their international tribunes into domestic political runs at the prime ministry. And that's what Ms. Freeland's doing. She's raised her name recognition in Canadian politics, and the appearance of her toughness against the Russians into a potential campaign to knock off the prime minister if domestic issues in Canada start to eat away at his polls. And that's what's happening to Mr. Trudeau. And it's inevitable, because he can't and won't address the real issues concerning Canadian voters. And the polls speak for themselves on that one. While Ms. Freeland can beat the drum against Russia and parade herself around the world as if she's above all that, and parade herself as pretty much in the same way that Mrs. Clinton paraded herself in the United States. And had Mrs. Clinton won, as Ms. Freeland was hoping she would do, then Freeland would have had perhaps an even better run at Trudeau's job than she has now. But in any event, my understanding of the matter, and I'm happy to be corrected by the folks listening, as well as by the much more experienced political correspondents in Ottawa, more experienced than I am, what's happening is that Ms. Freeland's ambition has run into two problems. One is obviously the Trudeau circle, and the second, who are jealous of their power and hanging on to it. And second, she's run into the Canadian foreign policy establishment, which backed Stéphane Dion as foreign minister and didn't appreciate the way he was dumped, and nor the way he was given a sort of double-headed sinecure, an ambassadorship in Brussels and in Berlin at the same time. There's been no criticism of Freeland's appointment from the foreign policy establishment that I can see yet, but there has been lots of criticism of the way in which Dion was disposed of. Does the latter mean the former? Concealed or whispered until it's clearer what Mr. Trudeau really thinks about Ms. Freeland? I don't know. But let's put it this way. If you're Sherlock Holmes, the clue here is the dogs that ought to be barking aren't. What are the non-barking dogs here? First of all, since beginning of March, when Ms. Freeland was called to account for her Ukrainian relatives, there hasn't been a word of endorsement from the prime minister, nor even a leak of endorsement from his circle to the press. Instead, Ms. Freeland's had to rouse dogs like Wells and others to bark in her favor, but they don't count. They count in the prime ministry, but not a bark there. Second, she hasn't been able to get the Jewish community supporting her. They've stayed silent. The Jewish organizations are at least as powerful ethnically in Canada, as everybody knows, as the Ukrainian ones. obviously the Ukrainian ones have backed her, but there are almost no Ukrainian voters in her riding. There are a lot of Jewish voters in her riding. There have been no statements of support for her or even condemnation, a small one from B'nai B'rith, but otherwise the Jewish organizations of Canada have stayed silent while the controversy has gone on. And the foreign policy establishment has been kind of silent on her. Jeremy Kinsman and other members of the Trudeau Foreign International Policy Advisory Council have been pretty silent too while they see what happens. When you sit on your hands and sit on your mouth, then that's an indication that there's deep disquiet about her and what she stands for and what she's capable of. But nobody's willing to put their views in their mouth except me, and I'm a foreigner. Mm. So what to say?
What are you hearing from your political contacts in Moscow? How are they viewing Ms. Freeland and her future?
Look, there's a it's a question of scale and size. Canada is not a significantly large country to attract the statements and priorities of a Russian administration that has more immediate and more direct concerns. Obviously, there's a war front in the Ukraine, and there's a war front in the south in Syria, and there's cyber warfare fronts, and there's conflict with Europe, and conflict with the United States, and conflict militarily in the Black Sea and in the Baltics. In these are the priority issues of foreign policy and military and security policy for the Kremlin, for Russian Parliament, for Russian Foreign Ministry. And Canada is relatively small in size and decibel level and significance. It's a member of NATO, but it's a small member of NATO. It's got a training force, a military unit in Western Ukraine, in Galicia, just as in Mrs. Freeland's home territory. But there's basically been no Russian address to Canada. The Freeland's has been sanctioned by Russia last year, and that's remained in place. That's been fully explained. The reason Freeland was sanctioned was a tit for tat for the sanctioning of Russian officials and individuals by the Canadians, by the then Harper government. It was tit for tat. It was an expression of, if you sanction our people for supporting the accession of Crimea, we will sanction your people for attacking us. And the explanation for the reason the sanction remains in place on Freeland is that it's tit for tat. If there were to be a lifting of Canadian sanctions on Russian officials for doing their parliamentary job, their representational job, or their official job, or expressing their opinion, if Canada relaxed its sanction, then there'd be an offsetting and reciprocal reaction from the Russian side. That's not a renewal of an attack on Freeland. It's simply saying, if things stay the way they were last year, they'll stay the same this year. If Canada wants to make – Canada initiated the sanction, Russia reacted. The Russian side simply regards Ms. Freeland as a small cog in a much bigger machine, and it addresses the bigger machine, not the small cogs.
Hmm. You know, John Helmer, this has been a really fascinating discussion. I really want to thank you for joining us, and I really look forward to having you back on again.
Thank you very much, Michael. Look forward to it myself.
We've been speaking with John Helmer, foreign correspondent living in Moscow. His articles appear on the site Dances with Bears at johnhelmer.net. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. joining me right now to speak to this issue of Chrystia Freeland and her family's Nazi collaborationist past. We're joined on the line by Richard Sanders. He is, of course, the coordinator of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade, as well as publisher of Press for Conversion magazine. And he spent a considerable amount of time researching this question as over the last several weeks as it surfaced. Thank you so much for joining us again, Richard.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate that.
Okay. You know, this question of the grandfather of our current foreign affairs minister, Michael Chomiak, it seems to have become quite controversial. And I found it interestingly, when I started posting about it on Facebook, some of my progressive people I'm used to thinking of as progressive minded and social justice oriented seem to be still thinking that this is some sort of a Russian plot to undermine Trudeau's cabinet or something like that. It's like they. So I guess what I kind of like to get from you, first of all, is kind of just secure the case. Michael Chomiak, he was, in fact, a Nazi collaborator, a chief editor of a newspaper, two papers that put out Nazi propaganda. Can you maybe, you know, like clear the air around this question? I mean, is there any possibility that he was somehow under duress, or can we say quite confidently that he was not only a willing but enthusiastic supporter of the Nazis, the Nazi cause?
I haven't seen any evidence to suggest otherwise, to suggest that he wasn't, you know, a willing, witting participant in this. He was there. He was the Ukrainian language, he was the chief propagandist in the Ukrainian language for the Nazis. His newspaper, the main one, the daily newspaper, which was publishing tens of thousands of copies per day by the end of the war, it was called the Krakow News, but it wasn't just circulated in Krakow, the capital of occupied Poland. It was a newspaper that was distributed across to Ukrainians across Germany, across occupied Poland, Czechoslovakia, and other countries that were allied to the Nazi regime. So it was widely circulated. It was the main source of information for the Ukrainian diaspora that was located throughout Europe. It certainly had... It was filled with the German spin on the news, you know, their various successes in the war, you know, what they were doing, what criticisms of the Allied powers, and of course this really vile anti-Semitic just hate literature, hate speech that it also published. He was the chief editor for that daily paper, but he also put out he was the chief editor listed as such in every issue of another paper, which was a weekly paper that was circulated in an area of occupied Poland where there were Ukrainians to the Ukrainian community within a certain region of occupied Poland. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and one thing that I've found really fascinating is his boss, this guy, Volodymyr Kubiyovich. He was the president of what was called the Ukrainian Central Committee, and he was also the chair and largest shareholder of a thing called the Ukrainian Publishing House. And that Ukrainian publishing house was the body which published many books, newspapers, magazines, including the ones that Chomiak was the chief editor of. So this guy Kubiyovich was the president of the Ukrainian Central Committee, and that was a quasi-governmental body that was based in Krakow, the capital of occupied Poland, and it was responsible for coordinating all of the collaboration between the Ukrainians and the Nazis. This was the Central Organizing Committee. It was actually established in 1940 by the Nazi military intelligence, the Abwehr, and this Ukrainian Central Committee was located in the same building as the Nazi military intelligence offices in Krakow. And the Nazis gave a huge amount of money, 50,000, 60,000 units of the currency at the time. And Tomiak's annual salary was 5,000, but they were getting 50,000 to 60,000 a month from the Nazis. And that money was handed over by a Nazi intelligence agent to Kobiyovich. And I have photographs of Kobiyovich, who's, again, it's Chomiak's direct boss. So I have pictures of him standing on a stage doing the Heil Hitler salute, along with a whole bunch of other Nazis. Kobiyovich is wearing a business suit, but he's with all these Nazi military guys, and they're all Heil Hitlering because they're standing there as a parade is walking by. A parade of Ukrainian recruits that have just come, the Nazis established a thing called the Waffen-SS Galicia in 1943. And that was done, Kubiyovich wrote an impassioned speech, and it was printed in the daily newspaper of Chomiak, and announcements were made about the formation of it in the other newspaper as well. Calling on Ukrainians to join up, to fight shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm with their Nazi comrades, to fight for the great Führer, to against their common enemy, the Bolsheviks.
Could you follow up on that point about, like, because I'm kind of curious to know what it was about this Ukrainian Central Committee and I guess this Ukrainian nationalist cause writ large that they would be so fiercely critical of the Soviet, the Bolsheviks, as you say, the Soviets, that they would align themselves with the Nazis?
Well, they had very strong fascist sentiments and ideologies all through the 30s, and actually going back to the Bolshevik Revolution of 100 years ago this year. So they had fought against the Soviets in between, I think it was from 1917 to 1925, they had a war against the Soviets because of the Bolshevik Revolution. The Soviets were, Soviet Russia was a new power and on the scene, and the Ukrainians wanted to have their own country, and so they were fighting against the Soviets. They also were fighting against the Polish. But these ultranationalist Ukrainians had also taken up in a very serious way the tactic of terrorism in the 30s, and they were assassinating Polish politicians. In fact, this is another interesting part of Chomiak's career, is that before the war, throughout the 1930s, you see, he actually graduated from law school. He got a degree. He didn't get his, I don't think he ever got his, he never passed the bar, but he did get his law degree in 1929. And then through the 30s, he got a job, he got a job as a reporter initially, a journalist, a court reporter. He was a young cub reporter covering trials in the Ukraine, and the Ukraine at that point was occupied by Poland. So there were these assassinations going on by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And he was covering those trials. And at the same time that he was covering the trials and supposedly being an objective journalist, you know, is what you might expect a journalist to be, objective, but of course we don't anymore. But anyway, he was at the same time as writing these the reports, the news about the trials, he was working for for different law firms that were helping him to get his to go through the hoops that were required to pass the bar. He had to do a number of years, I think 5 years of working for law firms in order to actually become a lawyer. So while he was doing that, he was working as a journalist, but he was at least one of the trials of the Ukrainian terrorists, assassins who had killed a Polish leader. He was working for the law firm that was defending the terrorists at the same time as writing supposedly objective reports.
So is there even any, was there any full disclosure about that apparent conflict of interest?
Full disclosure? well, he, we know this because there's we know about his, we know the names of the law firms that he worked with. From a form that he filled in, a German questionnaire he filled in 1946, he had to list his occupation he listed all the years and how much he got paid and who he was working for and everything like that for the Germans in 46, or for, it was a German questionnaire. I guess he was in a displacement camp with his family at that point. But this fact about him having covered the trial while working for the law firm, that was conveyed to me in a message, an email from Jean-Paul Himka, who's also related to Chomiak. He married into the family. But he's an academic in Edmonton who's done a lot of work to try to get the Ukrainian Canadian diaspora to recognize this, these facts about their history, and to acknowledge them, and to engage in some truth and reconciliation process of acknowledging the Ukrainian part in collaborating with the Nazis during the Second World War. He's done a lot of good academic research, and he married a daughter of Chomiak, of Michael Chomiak.
Now, that's you're getting to an interesting dynamic here when we talk about the Ukrainian diaspora within Canada. I mean, it's not a monolith. I mean, you had the earlier people coming over from around the time of the early 20th century and the late 19th, early 20th century. And then you have this later group coming in, this Ukrainian nationalist group. Could you maybe explain what the rationale, maybe the official versus the actual rationale for bringing in all of those people, particularly this new group of Ukrainians who were very different from the earlier group?
Yeah, well, one thing that while I think of it, that relates is a good way to maybe start answering that question is 1940. The Ukrainian Central Committee that I mentioned, which was the central body coordinating Nazi Ukrainian affairs during the war in Europe, it was formed by the Nazis in 1940, and its acronym is the UCC. Now, I just realized this a few days ago, that Canada formed its that when Canada formed what it called, or what they called, the Ukrainian Canadian Committee in 1940. It was in the same year, and the Canadian and the Nazi governments both created a body with the acronym UCC. I guess it's just a coincidence, but so what happened was as you were saying, earlier waves of immigration from the Ukraine were not all that right wing, and in fact, in Canada, the Ukrainian community was very ably represented, and the organizations that were most prominent within the Ukrainian community in Canada were quite left-wing, quite progressive. There were socialists, there were social democrats, and there were communists involved in those organizations. And over the years, the Canadian government has banned them. Banned their publications, made it illegal to be a member of those organizations, has confiscated their meeting houses, and in some cases given those or sold at very cheap prices. These confiscated meeting houses called labor temples were basically given away to the right-wing Ukrainian community. But the reason that Canada formed this Ukrainian-Canadian committee in 1940, and it's been renamed, it was renamed in the 1980s, it was called, when it was renamed the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. And that's an organization that still exists. It's quite, it says that it represents all Ukrainians, but of course it doesn't represent the progressive left-wing Ukrainians at all. They don't want to have anything to do with each other. But Chrystia Freeland and her grandfather before her were very involved with this Ukrainian-Canadian Congress. I think I would even say that Chrystia Freeland is now the most prominent spokesperson representing the UCC, that's the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress position, their spin on things. There's hundreds of references to her in their website. You know, over the years, they've very proudly congratulated her every step of the way whenever she, you know, accomplished anything. And she, so the reason that they created that thing in 1940, the Canadian government was instrumental in facilitating the creation of this UCC. The reason they did that was to create an umbrella group that would counter the influence and power of the progressive left-wing Ukrainian community in Canada, which had too much power. And the Canadian government has a long, very strong tradition of being anti-communist. It's made communism illegal a couple of times, and in turn, communists. So they wanted to create a body that could counter the power of the progressive Ukrainian-Canadian community. And so that's why they created that.
And they started bringing them in the 40s.
Okay, right. Yeah, after the war, there were in the late 40s and early 50s, the Canadian government facilitated the flow of tens of thousands, maybe 35,000 at least, Ukrainians to Canada. Thousands of these Ukrainians were veterans of the war who had fought against our allies, who had been Nazi. There were at least about 2,000 that were members of this Waffen-SS Galicia that I mentioned earlier, that where Kubilovich was on the platform saluting with all these Nazis as they walked past, because they had the thing had just been formed. And so he's saluting them as they walked past. And then years later, a lot of these veterans came to Canada. There were also veterans of other military formations that the Ukrainian nationalists had formed to fight for independence, but they were incredibly fascist, incredibly anti-Semitic, just really, really outrageous statements that they their leaders made.
Could you give us an example of some of these statements?
One thing that I should say before I give you some of these quotes is that Hitler's big lie, the main sort of enemy that they had, the main enemy was the communists, the Bolsheviks. But it's hard to maybe get people as riled up about that as you might want them to be, in order to go off and commit mass murder and to give up their lives and their safety and whatnot to have a war against the Soviets. So what they did was they tied it to another hatred that was commonplace at the time, and that was the anti-Semitism and the hatred of Jewish people. So they tied the enemies of those two enemies together, the Jews and the commies. And so some of the articles in his newspapers really conveyed that. Now, there was a series of articles that Himka did a really good essay on, which there was one series that the Nazis had asked the newspaper to run. It said, "We want you to run anti-Semitic articles." And they did. There was another series, a whole series of articles that were anti-Semitic, that were, there is no evidence that the Nazis asked them to run that series. And then there were just articles all over the place, you know, giving reports on speeches by Hitler and Goebbels and the Governor Hans Frank and other Nazi leaders, that, you know, there's no evidence that the Nazis, you know, said, you have to run these articles. They just did, because they were totally in agreement with the Nazis about who their enemies were. They hated communists and they hated the Jews, too. So they were quite happy to run those articles. So, for example, they would talk about, you know, the Bolshevik devil and the international Jew and Jewish world dictatorship. These are quotes from the newspaper. Hans Frank, he was later called the Butcher of Poland. He was executed after Nuremberg for war crimes and crimes against humanity. He had speeches that were, you know, that were printed in these newspapers, in both of the newspapers by Michael Chomiak. For example, it talks about, you know, how they needed to, the Ukrainians and Nazis were engaged in this battle against, you know, it was a good and evil kind of thing, and the German soldiers were seen on the side of morality, fighting for, quote, a Christian European culture and civilization, unquote, and that the evil that they were fighting against was called a dark nihilistic chaos, and they talked about, you know, Frank, for instance, says that he wants them to resolve to use the whole strength of your heart and all your work of your hands for the final destruction of our common enemy.
I wanted to bring up one more point before we close, and that's the issue of the truth and reconciliation framework, which you think is badly needed, because as you've pointed out, I mean, there seems to be so much of a willingness to ignore the links with the Ukrainian nationalist links with with the Nazis and the you know, the Canadian government's own anti-Semitism. So just as we've had this there's so much institutional unwillingness to even today, like lately we've seen with the Senator Bayak seeming to make excuses for the residential schools, and now we still seem to be unwilling to acknowledge this dirty part of our history. I mean, could you maybe?
Sure. One thing I want to say right off is that I found it interesting that Bayak, her name is a Ukrainian name. And she married a Ukrainian, and she pledged some money, I don't know how much, and in honor of her husband, to the monument for the victims of communism, you know, this controversial monument they're building in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So she made a contribution to that monument, anti-communist monument, in the name of her husband. So it sort of ties the two issues together, because she's now famous for being, for whitewashing the residential schools, trying to look at, focus on the good things that they did. The Ukrainian, this ultra-nationalist Ukrainian community has very serious problems in dealing with the truth of the past and of the Ukrainian collaboration with the Nazis. And they whitewash their role, their forebears' role in mass murder and ethnic cleansing as well, and in genocide. And it's quite a close similarity between these two issues of turning a blind eye to our history. Just as the Canadian society is supposed to be and really should be, taking a very serious look at our country's role, our nation's role in this horrific history of genocide against Indigenous peoples, the Ukrainian-Canadian community also really needs to take a very serious look at their own history and not deny or obfuscate or try to cover up the communities of people were complicit with the Nazi horrors have done far more work, you know, in recognizing their role in that, in those horrors. And Canadians whose forebears were involved in those horrors and complicit in it through spreading propaganda or through being veterans or whatever other, you know, prison guards or whatever they were, they need to take a serious look at that history and not ignore it, because you can't. It's not a solution to try to move forward and reconcile with that if we just keep ignoring the past. We have to recognize our complicity in these things and our group's complicity. So our forebears, whether directly related through blood or our cultural forebears, people we have, like the Ukrainian community, this ultranationalist community, still reveres as great heroes some people from the past who had absolutely atrocious ideologies that are anti-Semitic and incredibly fascist views of the world, and they need to stop worshiping those people as heroes. They need to and denying that they had anything, that they ever did anything wrong. You know, they try to pretend that, well, you know, we weren't siding with the Nazis, really. We were just fighting those horrible communists. Well,
sounds like Senator Bayak in a way.
Yeah. One thing maybe to conclude, one comment. If you talk about World War II and then you start blaming the Soviets to turn it into an excuse to throw hatred against the Soviets or communists or the Russians is the same thing as taking a discussion about the Holocaust and turning it against the Jews. And by that, I mean that because, as I said earlier, 25 to 30 million Soviets died fighting the Nazis. I mean, the Nazis had this massive attack against them. It was the largest invasion ever in human history. The Soviets turned the Nazis back and chased them all the way back across Europe to Germany. It was really the Soviets that won the war, and 9 million Soviet soldiers died during the war. So if 9 million Soviet soldiers died fighting against the Nazis, don't you think it's a little bit, it has to have a bit of nerve or chutzpah to use a discussion of World War II to start criticizing the Soviets? I mean, they were the biggest victims of the war. So how can you turn a discussion of that war into a tirade against the Soviets or against the Russians? I mean, it's just, it takes an incredible gall to do that. And so when Freeland, you know, her grandfather is exposed for being a Nazi collaborator, which he was, and she turns it into an excuse to slam the Russians and blame them, I mean, come on, that is just ridiculous.
Okay. Richard Sanders, I know we can go on for a long time because you've done a lot of research on this point, but I want to thank you for sharing these thoughts with us, and also to let our listeners know that you've got a 21-part expose on Chrystia Freeland and her grandfather's Nazi collaborationist past on your website, coat.ncf.ca. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me on. Okay. Thanks, I appreciate it.
So we've been speaking with Richard Sanders. He's the coordinator of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and publisher of Press for Conversion.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.